August 12th, Kerry spokesman Lanny Davis called John O'Neill, co-author of Unfit for Command, a liar. He said O'Neill lied in writing that Lieutenant William Shackey was aboard the Boston Whaler when Lieutenant Junior Grade John Kerry got his Purple Heart. That contradicts the Kerry camp's contention that nobody aboard a boat with Kerry has ever criticized him. Shackey, now a retired Rear Admiral, talked to me on the telephone yesterday. He said he was commanding the Boston Whaler, said there was no enemy fire, and said Kerry wounded himself accidentally. Is Admiral Shackey credible? He is the former Deputy Judge Advocate General of the Navy, and I think he tells the truth.
You know, he's just a right-wing Bush supporter.
Hell up, Robert Novak. This nonsense about Kerry wounded himself accidentally, according to some of these swift boat guys. Well, how did Boy George wound himself accidentally? By choking on his cocaine powder? Well, actually, why don't both Kerry and Bush accidentally kill themselves? And then you talk about how some rear admiral talked to you on the phone. Did he also, Novak, give you Valerie Plame's name? You know, the CIA operative that you outed for the Boy George administration? Hey, Novak, do us a favor. Out all of the names of the CIA operatives. I need more head coffins to build. You know what time it is, slave time. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1, Santa Cruz, 106.7, Illinois, LUVER.com, the world, and RadioForAll.net, the universe, Slave Revolt time. Tonight, we got a Beyond the Shadow segment, as we're going to be dealing with how even right-wing pro-capitalists are getting scared about the economic future and stability under corporate attacks of America. And then Gerald be shooting his way into the Making It Plain news. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1. Slave Revolt.
I wear garments touched by hands from all over the world. 35% cotton, 65% polyester. The journey begins in Central America in the cotton fields of El Salvador. In a province soaked in blood, pesticide sprayed workers toil in a broiling sun, pulling cotton for $2 a day. Then we move on up to another rung, Cargill, a top 40 trading conglomerate. Takes the cotton through the Panama Canal, up the eastern seaboard, coming to the U.S. of A for the first time, in South Carolina, at the Burlington Mills, joins a shipment of polyester filament courtesy of the New Jersey Petrochemical Mills of DuPont. DuPont strands of filament begins in the South American country of Venezuela, where oil riggers bring up oil from the earth for $6 a day. Then Exxon, largest oil company in the world, upgrades the product in the country of Trinidad and Tobago, then back into the Caribbean and Atlantic Sea, to the factories of DuPont, on the way to the Burlington Mill in South Carolina, to meet the cotton from the blood-soaked fields of El Salvador. In South Carolina, Burlington factories hum with the business of weaving oil and cotton into miles of fabric for Sears, who takes his bounty back into the Caribbean Sea, headed for Haiti this time. May she be one day soon free. Far from the Port-au-Prince Palace, third world women toil doing piece work to see a specification for $3 a day. My sisters make my blouse. It leaves the third world for the last time. Coming back into the sea to be sealed in plastic for me, this third world sister. And I go to the Sears department store where I buy my blouse on sale for 20% discount. Are my hands clean?
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
It is now Beyond the Shadow segment, and what we're going to deal with this time is the binds of capitalism. You know, Lou Dobbs from the Lou Dobbs Show on CNN. He's a CNN correspondent, has a little show on there where basically he preaches the greatness of the market systems. It's this corporate speak show. But recently, he's written a book concerning outsourcing and other things that have gone on and are going on with the corporations. Because even though he's a pro-capitalist hack for the U.S. empire, the reports that come in day to day before his eyes and the things that he has had to report on, at least for him, it has gotten... the better of him. And now this book has created a little bit of stir. And recently he was on I think his name is Bill Moyer on a PBS station. And they got into a discussion about Lou Dobbs' recent book and what's going on with outsourcing and the power of corporate America. So let's check out what these two have to say, and then we'll take it from there. Check it out.
U.S. corporations are sending American jobs overseas at such a rapid rate that this country's economy is facing a crisis of historic proportions.
All this from a lifelong Republican and avowed capitalist. And now there's more. A new book, Exporting America: Why Corporate Greed is Shipping American Jobs Overseas. Welcome to Now.
So great to be with you, thank you.
This book is more than an economic argument. It's a political manifesto. Let me read you the opening paragraph. Quote, the power of big business over our national line has never been greater. Never have there been fewer business leaders willing to commit to the national interest over the selfish interest, to the the good of the company over that of the companies they had. Are you saying that these companies are unpatriotic for outsourcing jobs?
I'm saying not that they're unpatriotic, but they're absolutely indifferent to the national interest, that they have given other interests primacy over the national interest. They've done so because, because of a cultural shift over the last 3 to 4 decades in this country, to the absence of a countervailing influence, countervailing political influence to the power of corporate America. Lobbyists, think tanks, across the board, the power of corporate America is unparalleled in Washington, D.C.
It's not just corporations that are outsourcing jobs. In your own book, you report 40 state governments, hospitals, even the nonprofit Smithsonian Institution, sending jobs abroad looking for cheaper labor and for skilled workers.
And in each instance, the enablers are corporate America. They are businesses whose business it is to kill American jobs and to ship those jobs overseas. This is insidious, it is spreading, it is absolutely dangerous in every respect.
Now, I'm no economist. I've made only a B in economics by sitting next to my wife, who was very helpful to me. She made an A. But even I know that services are now so much a part of any advanced economy that it seems inevitable that some service jobs will go to where they can be performed more cheaply.
I think that's right. And I think that international trade is a reality of our modern existence, and it should be. I believe, however, that the idea that our middle class should be forced to compete on a price basis with those workers in an emerging market who are making, in many cases, cents, while our CNTS, while our workers are making $15 to $20 an hour, is totally unfair. We're talking about not an economic judgment, but a political judgment, a social judgment. What kind of country do we want? Do we want to destroy the middle class? Because if we do, let's continue outsourcing jobs.
Now, what's interesting in part about this is that, while Dobbs is right on, some of these issues about as far as what is happening to the jobs and the growing power of the corporations, especially in this country, but it's also a byproduct of world events. The U.S. has much more imperial leverage in many ways because many of the countervailing forces, many of the counterweights that had existed since decades past have evaporated. You have a situation where China is as quickly as possible rolled up its so-called red carpet, and is saying, do you want some fries with those Big Macs? The Soviet Union says, no mas. We want to be flesh peddlers also. You have much of Latin America that, in comparison to decades ago. Now, there is like a rebirth of, some resistance, but it's still caught in that whole imperial web of neoliberalism and stuff like that. So the U.S., and by and large, Latin America, like Africa and many others, there's not even the pretense of competing with other different types of social political ideologies anymore. So Sam is basically running amok. And many places in the third world especially, which at one time at least had social political conscious forces to feed the minds of the masses in class analysis and resistance, many of those have been evaporated. 20,000 plus in the Sudan, evaporated. Afghanistan, undercut. Iraq, crushed. Many of these areas and many of the ways that they were crushed by the U.S. getting right-wing hocus-pocus fanatics, the Osama bin Laden types, to join forces in this little method of social-political house-cleaning, a form of biological social-political house-cleaning of ideologies that did not fit within the market for systems. They've worked. And now you've had, in the vacuum, many of these right-wing hocus-pocus type organizations throughout the earth in place. Now, all they can at best do is point the finger at Sam, who at one time many of them were collaborating with. But in a depoliticized world, many people are going for the hokey-doke. You know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't be against Sam, but you should also understand that these clowns often played or often stomp and hoof and hoop with Sam in destroying these political class analysis, class combative organizations. And now, you know, you just stuck in the dirt, you know, chanting some invisible man a few times a day. You're frustrated that all you got to eat is dirt. I mean, what the hell is going on? This is ridiculous. But in this desertification of analytical thought and class combativeness, you have a situation where now Sam has giant swaths of Indian reservations all over the planet to push his little products over. You know, jobs that they one time often had here and often had in Mexico. Now they got some new Indians on the reservation who have been crushed to the earth because of what has happened to the land underneath their feet, the political landscape underneath their feet. And now they're just pimping their products over there. So it's just not a situation where all of a sudden the big bad corporations woke up one day and said, oh, look, this has been a class battle that has been waged against the working classes in this country and throughout the world. And the imperialists are basically flapping their wings as quick as possible to take some of these jobs off to the next land to pimp the Indians over there.
Well, you know, this is actually a very serious matter. I was reading Karl Marx's Capital, and in that book, published by Vintage, a man by the name of Ernest Mandel does the intro. And he brought something up in the course of that book that's worth repeating now, and I just wanted to mention the source so you could read it yourself, hopefully. And that is, there are more, like years ago, they used to feed the white, you know, Aaron Volk, American proletariat, the myth that, look, you know, the reason why we do all the industrial work in Europe and here is because y'all are the only people that could do it. These monkeys can't, they don't know how to handle no wrenches and read no, you know, gauges and do all the technical stuff. You guys are guaranteed your jobs. You will always have a job. Not, we see now, that was hocus pocus. And what they did, they fed that racist myth to American workers, primarily white, to push the myth that somehow they were more qualified to do the hard-ass work that they did. More qualified, more able. Well, now that same exact work, and in fact, more technical work, if anything, is done in places like Indonesia, Brazil. Brazil, big, big airplane manufacturing facilities, big on it. We're talking about South Africa. We're talking about brown and black people all over this earth are creating the exact same products that the capitalists created here while they lied to the white American workers. Well, this is important because that was an important instrument, see, but that was used. But let's understand something. The proletariat is an international class. The working class ain't stuck in one place. So in a certain sense, we are stronger now, at least numerically, than we have ever been as a class in our history.
There's no doubt that you know, that was a stage, because all of these things are in motion and stuff. Many of these periods were periods where much of the third world was under colonialization and stuff. So they were used primarily for their raw resources and the indigenous population's exploitation in that particular formation. We've gone through at least a couple of different stages since then. So the dynamics are much different and stuff. And but the imperial conquest and domination of the ruling class's mentality and aspirations are still the same. Now next, Moyer asked Dobbs about the comparative advantage philosophies that once existed, and how laws like regulation and tort reform, how they play themselves out. So let's see what Dobbs has to say about this. Check this out.
But the law of classic comparative advantage, sure, has an effect that if a car can be made more cheaply in Mexico, that's where it should be made. If a telephone bill can be processed more cheaply in India, that's where it should be sent.
Actually, Ricardo did not suggest in any way.
The great economist.
The economist who is the father of the comparative and absolute advantage. He did not in any way suggest that you should have the middle class of any country competing with 30 million unemployed Chinese. He never dreamed about the portability of the factors of production, capital and labor, our knowledge base, our technological advantages, which are being exported and sent to these countries for no other reason than the fact that their labor is cheaper than ours. And the idea that we would put our labor force in competition with a labor force, in the case of India, that's basically double our size, most of whom speak English, and work for about a tenth of our wages, is a political judgment. It is not an economic judgment.
A political judgment?
Absolutely.
But libertarian economists like Rockwell on this show says it's government that's driving these jobs in the cities by their high taxation, by regulation, by the big cost of lawyers.
I think there's a good case to be made that that regulation, tort law, health care adds about, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, about 22% to the cost of goods. So what? It's part of the cost of a better life. That's what this society is. We're a democratic, free enterprise society, unparalleled in our success. Are we to absolutely turn back the clock on every achievement that we've made to improve the lives of our citizens in order for a U.S. multinational to get cheaper labor in Romania or the Philippines or India or China? I don't think so.
All right, now what you see once happening once again is a situation. Here you have a situation once again where it just exposes that the capitalists have no allegiance to the masses of people. They are in it for themselves and for expanding their own hegemony and for consolidating their power. If you look at the situation that happened in the 1930s, primarily, like say in Germany, you had a situation where you had the working class in Germany raging against the ruling classes in Germany. The U.S. Rulers in this society saw what was going on, and they saw that it was a good chance that the ruling class in Germany was going to not only falter completely, but collapse. And thereby, you would have a working class seize control in Germany if that were to take place. What they decided was to back not only the ruling segments in Germany, but to even back Hitler and company. All one has to do is read books like Fascism and Big Business, Saving Private Power, Henry Ford and the Jews, IBM and the Holocaust, and you'll see that the ruling classes in this society were more concerned about maintaining the same economic capital market order, then seeing an alternative system by a class that they completely despise seize control. Even if that meant going to war later with their capitalist counterparts to see who was going to divvy up what throughout the world and who was going to sell who what refrigerator. They were willing to blow up at least half the world, if not the whole world. But one thing they were not willing to see was a working class seize control. So there, right there, helps give an indication about their mentality and their allegiance. It's not to any particular country. The capitalists in this society's allegiance to a particular country is basically they just happen to be on a person who happens to be on the Dallas Cowboys. They happen to be on the Cowboys, so they down with the Cowboys. You know, another person's down or happens to be on San Francisco 49ers, so they down with the 49ers. They're still playing football. These guys are still playing capitalists, the capitalist game. One just happens to be in Germany. One happens to be in France. One happens to be in America. And they use the power, the military power, to and the propaganda power to condition their population, the masses, to go and kill each other, you know, to see who can, you know, get how much control, so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, they support each other because they look out for each other and help write the rules for what is tolerable and what is not tolerable. And what's not tolerable is an alternative system developing where the interests of the masses are held at the highest priority and the interests and power of the masses are held at the highest level.
Yeah, well, in actuality, there are some differences even between the ruling class of a single country. While patriotism, of course, is the last refuge of scoundrels, there are people that, you know, think that, you know, their country is better. Largely, though, what feeds that illusion is what kind of production they are engaged in. So, for instance, an automobile, when Henry Ford, even when he was giving money to Hitler, right, large sums of money to Hitler, and had very few facilities that were actually functioning outside of the country, I believe. Auto in America had not broke out into that international phase like it is today, where it's common in a lot of countries to have more than one plant from different countries. Still, it's pretty clear he supported Hitler in Germany. So that showed a certain international view that undermined his so-called patriotic duty. Remember, he was giving money and assistance to Hitler in the 1940s, while the war was still in progress. Now, the United States had not come down to its denouement with Hitler at that moment, but still, I mean, they declared war against them. They declared war against them in 41, you know. Well, the point is, it's unusual to see a capitalist funding the enemy in a war and also trading with the enemy during war, and Mr. Ford was, which is a confirmation of what you said. But at the same time, there are capitalists that produce strictly for the national market. They could be, let's say, retailers, like Montgomery Ward was until they went out of business. Like, you know, and at that time, you did not have this globalization of cheap merchandise coming in from China and places like that, like you do now. Those type of capitalists might be a bit more patriotic because their material interest is more insular.
The driving force of the international capitalists were knee-deep with Hitler. It wasn't just like Henry Ford, who had auto plants in Germany at the time. You had Standard Oil that was showing the Nazis how to convert aviation fuel to other products. You had General Electric building plants next to Auschwitz. And in part is because during that particular phase, it's true you had a certain amount of a split within the capitalists, but some of the split had to do with that they became, they started to idolize Henry and Adolf and Mussolini. That's exactly why you had a situation where legendary Brigadier General Smedley Butler, many of the capitalists in this country being envious of what was going on with Mussolini and crew and what Hitler was doing, they went to Smedley Butler, a highly recognized and highly praised general at the time, and asked him to perform a coup on the White House because they wanted to install a fascism within America. So basically, they saw a situation where they started to see the working class in their eyes, even though it was fascism was only going to work for a very short amount of time, but they saw this during that time as a method of being able to control the working classes in America even more. And they became envious of that type of situation. This is a time when, I would say the ruling class in America has developed even more so since that time. And they've crystallized and some of their strategies and propaganda and so on and so forth, almost to a point where, you know, at this point in time, they don't even need fascism. They got much of the American population on its heels at this particular point in time, and they're not in a particular crisis. So while there's always different segments going on and visions of America within the particular capitalist class about, one person being quote-unquote more patriotic than another, that's just a human thing. You have some capitalists who may be more racist than the other, but the driving force is the production, reproduction, and the expansion of the capitalist worldview. And that's what they're down with.
No, I was just going to say, I agree with that. And, I think that it's important to remember the bottom line. You know, I mean, if some capitalists jump on the program, thinking about the relationships between corporations and Germany, I was going to mention Braun coffee maker. You know, they made gas ovens. When they start seeing the bottom line, when they start seeing the profit in it, the benefits to it, you got a few capitalists in the beginning, setting trends and stuff like that. But eventually, it's a slippery slope, so to speak, that they're all going to have to internationalize or have multinationalist corporations in that manner set up in different bases throughout the world, flying, their own company flags, They ain't flying their own, ain't flying American flags, because, they, like you said, they ain't got no allegiance to America. I mean, the only fools that got allegiance to America are the gumpified, followers, that is, the masses, the people here in America, but the workers, for the most part. Papa was a rolling stone, I mean, he goes wherever the profits are,
That's why so many of these corporations have their accounts overseas so they can pay less taxes on these shores and stuff. Now, this within the financial market, Wall Street scheme of things, is considered good sound market strategy. So even if you are some little American patriot working for some company and stuff, if other businesses are sailing overseas, at least their bank accounts, you know, it's all electronic and stuff, as a way to avoid taxes, and we know the economic impact that has on schools and stuff like that, you're going to be accountable to those shareholders who are going to expect you to do the same thing, whether you got a flag wound up your behind or not. This is capitalism. Now, next, Lou Dobbs is asked about the obsolete skills issue and how that plays into things. So let's see how Dobbs responds to this. Check this out.
But isn't it an economic fact that people whose skills are obsolete or who don't seek the requisite education and training will be left behind in the world's changing markets, a world that Adam Smith and David Ricardo never could imagine?
I think that that is probably a fair statement, but not necessarily relevant to outsourcing. They're not sending those jobs overseas because the labor force in this country is not capable of conducting a business operation, of actually doing those jobs, not because they have an inferior education. They're doing so because the financial institution can pay cents on the dollar for labor in India or the Philippines or Romania and have to pay a living wage that provides a meaningful improvement in the quality of life for an American employee. And that's damnable to me. Do you remember through the 1980s and the 1990s when you heard corporate leaders and some of the best management consultants in the world talking about the empowerment of the employee, the importance of empowerment to provide the basis for innovation, the importance of having a happy, satisfied, educated, striving, aspirational employee in order to drive the successful corporation? That talk has disappeared. Corporate America, through its own devices over the course of the past decade, has created an adversarial relationship between the employee and the corporate leaders. And that's unfortunate. And so, yes, I think you not only can be sentimental, and I think there's room for it, but in driving a business, you have a responsibility to a variety of stakeholders. You have a responsibility not only to your investors, you have a responsibility to the marketplace, you have a responsibility to your customers, to the community in which you work, you have a responsibility to the country that makes your business possible in the first place.
Now, once again, you have a situation where, you know, as far as in the 1980s and 1990s, the corporations or corporate overlords were talking about working in solidarity with the employees, but they wanted happy employees and innovations and stuff like that. Look, the people who feel that they have the right to exploit other people's labor always try to pass off this myth of creating a happy worker. That's where the happy slave concept came from. You know, where we were supposed to be happy on the slave plantation, singing and happy. You know, never mind the fact of us not having any rights on the slave plantation as slaves. So they're always going to try to create some kind of mythology that innovation and other things, you know, so the cotton mill was developed. But you were still a slave. That just meant you had to pick more cotton. That's all that meant in the real world. And just like today, now with all these computers and stuff like that, instead of 8-9 hours a day, they expect you to work 14 hours a day. They expect to be able to get in contact with American workers all the time, at home and everything. They expect them to be online up to the workplace and stuff, 24 hours a day, ready to go, cell phone in hand, you know, so on and so forth. And part of this is because the illusion of innovations in technology being a liberating force is just that, an illusion. If you don't have control, if the workers don't have control of the technology, it's a weapon of the ruling class. So you have a situation where years ago, we went down to the 40-hour work week, you know, like in the 1930s and stuff. Now, with the development of technology and stuff like that, in a sane, rational society, people should be down to like 16 hours a work week now, if not less.
Right.
But since the power of technology is in the hands of the rulers, because the control of the means of production is still in the ruling class's hand, that technology is turned against us.
That's exactly right. And I have to add something. Very excellent point. And this is the point that people need to get. But it's worse than that. This is dying capitalism. See, this is capitalism in its death throes. There was a time when technological improvements and inventions improved the life of everybody, including the working class. Let me give you an example, Trace. The light bulb. You know, one would argue that when they invented the light bulb and got electricity to, you know, be a common thing among homes, that this technological improvement from just being out in the prairie desert, you know, looking at reading at the moon, with the moon, like, was an improvement. Sure it was. I'll give you another one. The train. You know, locomotive. The invention of the locomotive, steam locomotive, and then the, you know, development of a national network of tracks improved the life. This technological development improved the life of even ordinary people. It was not unquestionable now. You could see your mother again. If you moved to California in 1850, if you wanted to go back to see your mother by 1865, if she was still alive, you could do that. That was within your reach. Whereas it was not formally within your reach. That was in your reach. It did make life a little better. But just as Tracy said, now let's look. Dying capitalism. That's capitalism when it was still on the upswing. You know? When it was conquering the world. When it was a virile young organism, like a young man. Now we're looking at capitalism like an old man, decrepit, no teeth, hair done fell out, pus and shit coming out his eyes. This is the capitalism we're dealing now with veins. You understand? Just blood just gushing out all over him. This is a bloody monster. That's what dying capitalism looks like. And here's what it does. Even when there is a technological improvement, like, let's take one, the computer. And he just said it. Did the fact that the computer was developed into the microcomputer. Now, they had computers for years. They made these mainframe computers, etc. But I'm talking about the microcomputer, when it went around the world at lightning speed, did it really improve the life? And I'm not talking about some silly-ass game that kids like to play or email, but did it really improve your life? It certainly did improve someone's profits.
Yeah, Bill Gates. But, on that note, on the computer tip, you know, I mean, that's a good point because, you know, I mean, for instance, computers, you know, theoretically, you have the ability to work from home and all that kind of stuff. But workers still don't do that, you know what I'm saying? I mean, for the most part, I mean, it's still about, serving the boss and making sure that they got the lion's share of the cash and wealth in their pockets.
Now, next, Dobbs is asked if he is a traitor to his particular class of people for coming out with this book and saying what he's saying. Check this out.
Heresy. Are you a traitor to your class, the investor class?
Well, I think most of us are investors, and I hardly think I'm a traitor. I think it's traitorous and treasonous and absolutely ignorant for these people to be ballyhooing double-digit returns on equities when first, we have to get our house in order in this country and bring back integrity, principle, leadership to our business enterprises, to our markets, and try to do a lot better for the people who count. That is the middle class.
The powerful editorial page of The Economist says Lou Dobbs has embarked on an anti-trade tirade and that you greet
each new announcement of outsourcing, like the one in the New York Times this morning, as akin to a terrorist assault.
Right. Well, the excess, I assure you, is not on my side. Those critics, whether it be The Economist, a number of other writers, using language like that, it's silly. And they're not dealing with the arguments that I'm putting forward. The argument I'm putting forward is simple. Don't put our middle class at risk by forcing only one element of our society and our economy to compete against the world, particularly cheap foreign labor. I'm not on a GM. I'm trying simply to wake people up, trying to point out that we deserve far better representation in Washington than we're getting. And corporate America deserves somewhat less representation in Washington.
You know why? He's being honest here. This is a capitalist that is concerned about capitalism. And why on earth would he be concerned at this time? Because if you break the American working class down to the same exact standards that workers, let's say in Latin America, making a dollar, and if they're lucky, $2 a day, if we break the American people down to that level, what do you think the consequence is? See, this is something these corporate idiots have run around just staggering drunk with power and wealth just oozing all over them. They don't even know what to do with it. Well, what do you think happens when you break the American, the most powerful working class in the world, by the way, down? Not politically, not in terms of their consciousness, but in terms of their cohesion, skill level, and all of the other things that go along with overthrowing capitalism. What do you think when that working class starts to get that message? See, there you are starting to see capitalists that are worried that these corporate idiots are just being too foul, too greedy, too vile, unnecessarily adversarial. The workers are disoriented, and they are. And so there's a wing of the capital class that has just gone for it. Rip them off. Take it all. The health care. Fuck them. Take it. They ain't looking. Take it. The pension. Take it. And they did. They took people's pensions, and they are currently taking away the health care for millions of Americans. The figure is not even out yet, how bad it is, how many Americans currently do not have any health care. It's not even out for 203. And the reason it's not out for 203 is not that they don't know. They don't want you to know. Because it's bad news, brothers and sisters, when people can't even go to the doctor in the richest country in the world.
Now, it's interesting listening to Dobbs because he's a pro-capitalist component. He's not really a capitalist. You know, he's has his little talk show, and he has historically been a proponent of the market capitalist system. He's very worried, there's no doubt, because he's seen all of this stuff. The reports come, you know, every day. You know, he does interviews and stuff like that. It's interesting watching him over the last year, because he's been reporting on it over the last, he's been finding himself attacked all over the place, Wall Street Journal, so on and so forth. Much of the ruling class, they're not even really concerned at this time. You don't really see that much debate in ruling class circles, you know, like in the Wall Street Journal and things like that, about what's going on, should they pull back. And in many ways, it's kind of interesting because, see, like Dobbs, in some ways, he's so caught in this illusion of the ruling class that when he says, like Dobbs says, they don't want to put, you don't put our middle class at risk of basically complete annihilation by making them compete with the third world. But see, he has this kind of altruistic look at the world. These are ruling class imperialists who will murder your mother in a second. They have created genocide all over the planet. You know, Nicaragua, Cambodia, Vietnam, Angola, Iraq. It's nonstop how vicious these cats are. So when they're talking about when Dobbs is talking about don't put the middle class competing with the third world, these ruling class sectors in America, what they're thinking about is competing against other capitalists throughout the world. You know, that's how they're looking at it. So the working class in this country and throughout the world are just pawns on a chessboard to be manipulated and crushed and passed around and flipped over and, you know, night takes, you know, knock you down and stuff like that. In many ways, what is starting to happen to a broader segment of the working class in this country is in many ways the canary in the mine, what has already happened to many segments of the black community, where we've seen hundreds of thousands of jobs in the black working class evaporate. You know, South Central, over 100,000 jobs evaporate. This was all part of a class attack that was intentionally engineered to not just for greed, but to condition to beat the black working class masses down, to crush us into the earth, to disperse us, to confuse us, disorientate us, to then use other laws when things go into various forms of chaos to justify other further attacks on us.
But just a side point, just a sidebar, Trace. In the process of deindustrializing, we talked about South Central and, you know, and those parts of L.A. that were deindustrialized. Oakland was a real working-class city, little industries everywhere. You could, in 1975, I came in, you could get a job for $10 an hour almost anywhere. You know, working in small factories, stuff like that. Union, you know? Who did they... not only did they beat down the working class, they had to destroy smaller capitalists. Predominantly white, by the way. Don't never be fooled by their viciousness. By
who's
what they're
being fooled?
I'm talking about our listeners.
All of this merger stuff and development that you see going on, that's that whole survival of the fittest within the parameters of the marketeers and stuff. I mean, Time Warner, every time you turn around, Viacom is owning more stations and, you know, being more of a conglomerate and stuff like that. At one time, when various guys wrote the books on the corporate media, they were talking about, like, you know, the 100 media, how there was 100 dominant media stations and how this was a great consolidation of the media structure over the last 20 years. Now it's down to 5. You know, so now many of those guys who got swept up that weren't even part of that 100 that I mentioned were little guys. But they got devoured up, you know, within that whole rush, because in the consolidation of power, that's all part of, you know, the mindset of, you know, the market orientation. Now, next, Dobbs is asked about the big business influence in America and the world, and how this is affecting and infecting various aspects like the academic world. So let's check out what Dobbs has to say. Dig this.
Some proportion, some balance.
You say in your book that, quote, corporations have overwhelmed government in the borderless global economy. How so?
They've overwhelmed it because they have had the maximum influence in lobbying the creation of international trade agreements in the direction of this economy. The World Trade Organization, NAFTA, it now turns out, are really outsourcing agreements. They give corporate America an opportunity to move plant production and, yes, jobs to Mexico, to any part of the world, and ship back into this market.
But your book is somewhat pessimistic on this, because, as you say, this didn't just happen. This is the result of political decisions over the last quarter century. And you say big business all but controls the knowledge base in which Congress usually makes decisions.
Absolutely.
Affecting economics and business. And that corporate interests spend more money on lobbying than the federal government spends on the staff of Congress.
That's right. We need a countervailing influence to corporate America. At one time, it was organized labor. Labor has been so weakened in this country by both the force of corporate America and also by its own missteps and misjudgments and weaknesses. We need to find a role for institutions that can provide countervailing influence. What concerns me deeply, though, is that academia, our universities, many of them, who resisted the funding by the CIA or the federal government in the 60s and 70s are more than quick to embrace those dollars from corporate America. Understandably, they want the money. But the fact is, we're beholden at all cross purposes to corporate America. The independence of thought in this country, a countervailing influence, is just not there.
Aren't both parties, in effect, wholly owned subsidiaries of the big corporate donors?
Absolutely. And to watch the hundreds of millions of dollars that have moved into this campaign bill, I know has to make you as sick as it does me. Because after McCain-Feingold, it turns out there were one or two minor loopholes through which about $500 million managed to move. Yes, both parties are absolutely loath to offend corporate America. They're loath to look out and say, you know, we're a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Because I don't think the people, based on the reaction from my viewership, feel like they're being adequately represented.
See, part of the reason why I'm playing Dobbs is because it's when you have even right-wing pro-capitalists sounding the alarm bells, who are watchers for the ruling class. They are constantly checking the wind of the masses to see which way and what tide things are blowing, and helping to propagandize out the mythology of the market system. When they become worried, that's an indication of how even helpless he feels he is. Now, of course, he's not going to have the overall confidence in the working class masses to develop his own independent class combativeness to take control and just smash the capitalists all the way down. He just wants some reforms. So basically some Naderite type to come in at the end of the day when things are really rocking and rolling and try to put some restraint on the capitalists, you know. So then they'll all be singing Nader's praises then. But it's interesting that, like I was saying before about how the capitalists have also used the myth of the market systems and how that has penetrated so deeply in the third world and in America. So even where in the academia, as Dobbs said, that they frown at the CIA, you know, taking money from the CIA, or at least openly, but they have they open their palms up when it's corporate America. Now, this is similar to how you've seen contradictions, and you heard me talk about these things before. If you take the various cases about how scientific integrity and issues are being discussed. So like with the case of AIDS, the whole HIV/AIDS type thing. Duesberg, as you've heard on this show before, has been a proponent against the HIV causes AIDS. And he's discussed how it doesn't follow the scientific method of following postulates, where it has to be found in the three postulates and cost postulates to be considered an infectious disease. HIV fails it, but somehow it's just ignored. You often have people babbling right in front of your face about HIV causing AIDS, and it's failed openly the Koch postulate scientific method. This is a method that's been used for, you know, about 100 years now. Now, what has happened, if you follow what has happened in Duesberg in particular, you've seen a situation where GlaxoSmithKline, along with a lot of other corporations, are now deeply embedded in at the University of Berkeley. And many of the students who want to be graduate students and other things have been told, look, if you go help Duesberg out in his labs, I don't know, it may have an effect on your future career. So Duesberg is getting defunded by these by pressure from corporations. The students are an effect on your future career. So Duesberg is getting defunded by pressure from corporations. The students are being whispered in their ear about their future career being affected if they just go help out in his labs. So this undermines people who are making an argument, a scientific argument, not a political polemic. Because a lot of what's going on in the HIV/AIDS stuff is just political polemics about the whole H. This is how, in essence, you can have, in America and in Europe, HIV/AIDS is defined as having one of 30 diseases. It could be Kaposi sarcoma, leukemia. You could have any of those diseases, one of 30, and HIV, finding HIV antibodies in your body, then they'll say you have AIDS. But if you go over to Africa, they go by a whole nother definition because it doesn't work. So you don't even have to have those one of 30 diseases. You can have one of four symptoms: dry cough, weight loss of 10% body weight in 2 months, malaria, constant diarrhea. Constant diarrhea is not a disease. It's a symptom of something. And you can be diagnosed as being an AIDS candidate. Now, how in the hell can you, a scientific community that's supposed to have integrity and is now trying to ship all of these so-called AIDS drugs off to Africa, be able to give an indication of how eroded the scientific process has come and the role, in part, the corporations have played in disintegrating the scientific process, all for their corporate greed and expansion?
See, the corporations also play a role in all this whole thing, in this whole thing of how AIDS was defined, because different corporations wanted to get behind certain doctors. Certain doctors come up with some advance and say, well, this is the... Then they can say, oh, okay, we are producing, you know, the results of so-and-so's work. So you get patronage working its way into this thing, which should have nothing to do with it. The real question is, hell, save us from this deadly disease. Racism. I know
get a real definition of the disease.
That's right. Hey, they can't even get that right. But racism. Now, here we go. One of the things that racism does, it leads to the devaluation of black life, pure and simple. Okay? So how do I translate this to Africa? How in the world, if you come in the United States, if you're here in the United States, somebody say to you, I think you got AIDS, and you don't think you do, you'd probably smack them. Take it seriously, at least. But at the end of the day, if you have never been tested, and your blood taken, and a test put on that blood, that person would be laughed out of town claiming that you have AIDS. Do you know that in Africa, they do not give people tests when they declare that they have AIDS, and it's called science? This is what these so-called NGOs go around. That's why there's so little regard for them in many parts of Africa. Yeah, we eat the food. Yeah, we take this and that from. But there's so little respect, because how are you going to tell me that in Africa you don't need a test? And you can tell me how many people got AIDS. That's why there's, what they say, 10 million people in South Africa got AIDS. Stop and think about that. If that were real... Stop and think about that. They said that, by the way, more than 10 years ago. Now, let's just say, if that were real, there would be no South Africa. Obviously, that was Huey.
All of the so-called hot spots in Africa, where they were supposed to be epicenters, they bounced around at least 7 or 8 times, where they were supposed to be epicenters and where the population was supposed to go in a negative in the years to come. None of those areas... has the population gone in a negative growth factor? They're all still in a positive growth factor. And part of these things that...
Without correction.
Part of these so-called autopsies that they had, what they really were like what they call verbal autopsies. So they'd ask, oh, say, how did so-and-so look when he died? And then the native would say, well, you know, he got real skinny and so on and so forth. We think he had the Slim disease, which is generally some parasitic disease, you know, from water and all of that type of stuff. But, you know, in the whole rush of AIDS is conquering the world, they just chalk it off in a verbal autopsy, non-scientific, no blood taken, as that person dying of AIDS. And you just had this thing go on and on And with the CDC's different definition of AIDS in Africa called the Bankwe definition, this has helped confuse this whole process. Now, next, Dobbs talks about his vision of national development. So let's see how Dobbs responds to this whole process, Dickless.
You began with a stunning quote. I'll read it. Quote, the 20th century has been characterized by three developments of great political importance: the growth of democracy, the growth of corporate power, and the growth of corporate propaganda as a means of protecting corporate power against democracy.
Absolutely. Corporate America has, at this time, taken controls the national media. It controls nearly every avenue of an American citizen's access to information about the way he or she lives, about those forces that are influencing our lives. And corporate America is protected in Washington by the dollars it spends. It is protected in the media by some virtue of ownership.
Do you see any sharp differences between the two parties in this campaign on this issue? I mean, John Kerry has been calling these CEOs. You write about Benedict Arnold. But do you see in the platforms and the performance and the history of these two parties any profound difference?
Unfortunately, no. The Democrats brought us. WTO. They brought us. NAFTA in concert with the Republicans.
Well, to all the little lesser of two evil Democrats, sorry.
Open up your ears.
Sorry. But even Lou Dobbs is further advanced on this particular issue than you are, in seeing that as long as you have illusions about the punk who rides the elephant as opposed to the punk who rides the donkey, without realizing that they'll both buck you off if you try to ride them and stomp you to death in the end. And you're not going anywhere fast. Hold on a sec.
What you're seeing is, first of all, the Vietnam War continues to divide Americans 30-some years later. And when new revelations come out, that can tend to crystallize opinions as well. John Kerry served in Vietnam, and so the issue of Vietnam comes up again with all sorts of explosive concepts that people are kind of clinging to here. And one is that Kerry came back from Vietnam, and instead of supporting the war, he condemned the war. And I think that that's what is dividing a lot of, obviously it's being used for campaign purposes, but it also has a tendency, again, to divide Americans. Found, essentially, was that there was a unit, very small, mobile platoon known as Tiger Force, that was unleashed into the Central Highlands in Vietnam in 1967. They dangerously and very violently lost control. This wasn't fog of war stuff. This was where they went into villages and premeditatedly executed, murdered men, women, and children at random. They cut off their ears. There was body mutilation. They cut off the head of an infant. They routinely saw women, children hide in bunkers, and they threw in grenades. This went on and on unabated for 7 months, from May through November of 1967. The Army launched a 4.5-year investigation between 71 and 75, substantiated, that is, they developed probable cause in about 20 war crimes involving 18 soldiers, multiple victims, untold hundreds, and then quickly and very systematically shut the case down and concealed it. It had been buried in the archives of the Army for the last 36 years until we were able to get rare classified documents about this case, and we continued to press for more records. The Army said no. We were able to get them regardless, and in addition, we interviewed more than 100 members off and on who rotated in and out of Tiger Force during that period. The atrocities are well documented. They're well known. They're not in dispute. Dennis was a military journalist at the time. He was sent briefly into the Songhay Valley, and Dennis witnessed Tiger Force carrying out several of its atrocities, including the execution of 35 villagers in a field. In a rice paddy, unarmed civilians, men, women, and children. He tried to bring this to the attention of both a chaplain as well as a commander in the battalion, but his pleas were unheard. He was told simply to let it go, to forget it. He was never in a position, if he had written about it, it would have been censored, it would have been killed, essentially. So Dennis was one of the people that actually saw Tiger Force in action, and then later, after his discharge from the Army, brought this out in tried to bring it out, but at every turn it seemed like he was met by resistance, and eventually the Army investigated very briefly his complaints, but they ended up interviewing and investigating the wrong company at the time, and so here he is 35 years later still trying to get answered. He had been trying to follow up on whatever happened to his complaints, and they kept telling him that the files were missing, they weren't around. And then in our search at the National Archives, we were able to actually find about 25 to 30 documents relative to his case. They did investigate it. They did look into war crimes. They did interview soldiers. And then they essentially shut it down and told Dennis that they had never actually even investigated it. As it turns out, when he got the records, he found out they actually had investigated the wrong company. He had told them about war crimes involving one particular element of the battalion, and they never even went to that element, did their investigation. They went to another. So he was confused and for many years left in the dark as to whatever happened.
The 8 war crimes that I reported to the Civil Investigation Division, which are the detectives of the Army, they investigate cases and then move them on to the Army prosecutor for either a recommendation of prosecution or not. I first tried to report these in 1967 while I was a member of an infantry unit, and after one of the crimes, the rape and murder of a girl about 17, I walked cross country about 2.5 or 3 clicks by myself to get to a base camp to report these, and I went to my sergeant major and tried to report them, and he said, well, you better keep quiet or you'll get a lot of good people in trouble. So I went to my captain and told him about him, and he said, you better shut up about that kind of thing. So then I went to the chaplain, thinking he would care, and he once a month got to fly to Saigon for a chaplain conference, and I thought he could get word out and get investigators to come in and check this out. Instead of doing that, he reported me to the sergeant major as a troublemaker. So I was called into a meeting several hours later with the sergeant major, my captain, Captain James, and another captain that I was he was introduced to me only as a captain from general staff. And the exact words I was told was, Stout, if you didn't have such a good combat record, you'd be dead already. But if you say another word about this, you're not coming back alive from the next operation. Do you understand that? And I said, yes, sir. He said, dismissed. And I turned around to leave, And the other captain from general staff said, oh, and by the way, we're taking away your medals. And I said, big deal. Left the tent. So, I should describe the nature of our unit. There were only two airborne units in country, the 173rd and the 101st. And we were a light brigade, which means there were only three battalions. And there were only three battalions, I believe, of the 173rd. Our unit was General Westmoreland's old unit, and he had moved up to be commander of all U.S. troops in Vietnam, commander of MACV, it was called. And so he would send the people he knew from West Point down to serve with our unit. And any officer that was airborne qualified and infantry qualified to get their next promotion had to serve with a combat infantry unit. So since there were only three battalions, there was only one opening for a general, three openings for battalion commanders, and then, you know, captains and majors down the line. And all of our officers were West Point. So, and we got new officers all the time because they had to rotate them through quickly to get, as was put by the former, one of our former colonels, Colonel Hackworth. He said recently in a newspaper interview that body count was the way you got your ticket punched. You had to get a certain level of body count to get your next promotion. So we got a new general every 30 days. We got new light colonels every 45 days. I mean, bird colonels every 45 days. And new light colonels either every 30 days or 45 days. Our lieutenants served 4 months with us before they went on to something else. If they lived, they died quite frequently. And our captains served 4 to 6 months before they moved on. So we were constantly getting rotating new officers who had to get their body count and, if possible, a little bit of publicity to help move them to their next rank. So, I was kept quiet through that period. I served out my time at Fort Huachuca, Arizona, training troops. And then when I got out of the Army in February of 1969, the My Lai story broke shortly after that. And My Lai had occurred in the same valley where we had done this stuff, further toward the mouth of the valley, committed these crimes. So I went public immediately with the 8 war crimes that I could most closely document. I witnessed a lot more than this, but these are the ones where I had ID cards of the people killed. See, the South Vietnamese government would issue these laminated ID cards to people that were considered loyal citizens. And of course, we didn't give that any standing. But I had ID cards of some of the people killed, location on the ground, sometimes within 50 meters, and the names and unit numbers of the people who committed the crimes. And those are the only 8 that I reported to the CID, because I wanted to stick to what I could absolutely prove, I felt. The crimes were the rape and murder of a young girl that I spoke of earlier, where she was seized at a road guard operation, raped and beaten for 2 nights, and then taken out and shot. They took her right outside of our little perimeter and told her to run so that they could shoot her. And she wouldn't run because she knew what they were going to do. So they backed away from her and threw a grenade that rolled up at her feet. And when she saw the grenade, she used one hand to cover her eyes and the other hand to cover her chest. When the grenade went off, it tore off one leg and shredded the other one. But she was still alive, so the guys walked up and shot her twice to finish her off. I also, at that same road guard place, one guy decided he wanted to try to skin someone. So he caught an old man and tied him to a tree and began skinning him at the top of his left shoulder and down his chest. And he got about 3 inches down when the guy passed out. So then he revived him by slapping him and throwing water on him. And when he came to, he tried to skin him again. He only got about another inch or so. And the guy passed out again, so he shot him. After he shot him, he said, well, he's no fun anymore. So one of my sergeants, Sergeant David Kalu, we had captured a guy asleep in his hammock with his rifle leaning against the tree and 2 bundles of punji sticks rolled up under the hammock. And after we captured him, he tied him to a tree and then tied cords around his upper arms and around his thighs and then took an axe and started to chop him apart from the bottom up and eventually chopped off his arms and legs and head and piled them on the trail as a message to any gooks that came down the trail. At one point, I captured an old woman that could barely walk and couldn't see very well. We had chopped her garden up, all the melons and squash and things, and we saw movement out in the garden while we were having lunch, and she was out there picking up the pieces and stacking them back together. And the guys were going to shoot her, but I decided to just go up and capture her, I guess, you know. So I walked up, and she saw me coming and tried to run, but all she could do was barely shuffle, not even as fast as I could walk. So I went up and tapped her on the shoulder and motioned for her to come with me and took her over to where the guys were. And they were teasing me about, what are you going to do with her now, you know? So I got on the radio, and I called the S2, which is the intelligence portion of the battalion, because we happened to be a battalion online at that time, moving through the valley, which is a rare formation to use. But so the S2 wasn't far away. And he asked what the problem was, and I said I had a special situation. So about 15 minutes later, a specialist 4th from the S2 showed up. He said, where's your special situation? And I showed him the old woman. And he said, you called me up here for that. And he went over and grabbed her by the back of her dress right behind her neck and took her over to the side, pulled out his .45 and shot her in the back of the head. Then he came over and grabbed the radio and said, this is S2 Bravo Oscar, 1VC KIA, out. And hung up the thing and he said, that's how you handle your special situations.
Sisters, friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm Gerald Smith. This is your Making It Plain News Service. The Justice Department announced on Friday, that is today, that it is launching a criminal investigation into Riggs Bank. In recent months, the Washington-based bank has become engulfed in a scandal related to charges of money laundering, corruption, and terrorist financing. Oh, did I mention? These people are close to George Bush. I'm not, I know y'all think, I swear to God. That's why it's a scandal. But you know what? Not surprising. It's only a scandal because they want to make it into a scandal so they can make believe they can't believe it, so that they can believe it and still follow George Bush. Get too complicated for you? Dig this. They tried to pump everybody up and scare everybody up about what's going to happen in New York Monday. Oh, the anarchists are coming. The anarchists are coming. Not only the anarchists. Code Gray, alert, y'all. Check for character reference from local documentarian. And what you're going to find out is that you've been lied to again. They over there in New York telling people that the Black Panthers is organizing in New York. Oh, they said the Weather Underground, the Black Panthers, and the Symbionese Liberation Army. Now, is this the stupidest? Sorry, you know what's kind of funny about it, though? They finally went on, and this chick from me, this is sorry. Well, might as well, the truth has set you free. Ye shall know the truth, and it shall set you free. The veterans of the Black Panthers have moved on to other things. Everybody knows. Mr. Seal was called and he said, teaching, writing, and sympathizing with much the younger generation of protesters do. And so have the weathermen. Quote, the Weather Underground doesn't even exist Mr. Seal said. I would know. They would call me. And we could reminisce. Yeah, well, that just shows you. Old Bush and his son got downright silly. Downright silly. There is a united front to abolish the queue from all prisons. And recently they came from as far as Los Angeles, Santa Cruz, San Jose, San Francisco, and Sacramento to protest against what the SHU stands for, Security Housing Units, at Office of the California Department of Corrections in downtown Sacramento. S Street between 15th and 16th. I'm not there yet. Oh, but I'm still trying. Hello? All right. Well, I don't hear nothing coming out. Okay. You don't press a button. All right, here we go. Well, so basically what happened was the people marched to Sacramento. And in that march, they told people, you know, they tried to confront the CDC, which is good because the SHU must go. Several organizations were involved. I would say the Barrio Defense Committee being among them. Okay. Look, just to give you a sense of the average war report, here are some of the things that are going on. Now, we already know that 971 USGIs are confirmed to have been killed in Iraq. Actual troop loss may indeed be higher. If you listen to Slave Revolt, you know it is. This does not take into account the many thousands who have been wounded and disabled. So, and recently, this gives you a sense of what is Sam facing, what's going on in Iraq right now. Well, the Thai troops have withdrawn from Iraq. Those troops prepared to withdraw from Iraq on Friday after completing a year-long humanitarian mission in the war-torn country, officials said. A Kuwait firm has bowed to kidnappers' demands and stops work in Iraq. Now, they try to tell you, like everybody in the terrorist system, we don't negotiate with terrorists. Well, check this out. The Kuwait firm, which has several truck drivers held hostage in Iraq, has decided to halt operations in the troubled country, bowing to the kidnappers' condition for their release. It said Friday. Get the hell out! Happens every day, y'all. We just don't get to know about it. Don't you wish Slave Revolt came on every day? Yeah.
That just means I'll just have more business to do in my new business, the head coffin industry. That's all it means. Stay on down there.
Oh, man. Well, that's basically what happened. Now, Spec Charles L. Neely, 19 of Matsu, Illinois, died August the 25th in Dairit, Iraq, when his tractor trailer rolled over and he attempted to access a pontoon bridge. Another confirmation. Soldier killed in vehicle accident. One soldier is dead, another injured after the truck the two were driving and rolled off an embankment about 4:45 a.m. August 27th near Fallujah.
Hey, you know, on the Discovery Channel, tomorrow they're going to have a little thing about shipping out of Arkansas. It's basically these two documentary guys did a documentary where they follow these National Guardsmen who found themselves lassoed by Boy George and Company and shipped off into Arkansas. And the Negroes, you could tell, don't want to go. They singing little hip-hop song. I don't want to go. You know, what you taking me for? And all this. And say, I don't see any of Bush's sons going. You know, any Bush's kids going, any of his relatives. Saddam ain't done, those Iraqis ain't done nothing to me. So it follows them down there, along with some other guardsmen. And sure enough, within the first few days they're down there, here comes a mortar. Kaboom. Four of them. Gone. So they played like a 1 hour version of the documentary for whatever reason the other night. But tomorrow they're supposed to play a full 2 hour documentary.
Channel
Discovery Channel.
Okay, thank you for that piece of information. By the way, I got to tell y'all, all of y'all that think y'all was slick and in the reserves and getting that extra money and playing Sam for yours and all the kind of sap stories I've heard in the last year, you know, because I know a lot of people in the military. People be in the military. They go on the weekends and then, you know, and all that stuff. And I ask, what do you get out of that? And boy, they brag about, yeah, well, I get a retirement. I get this, I get that, and that. Yeah, look what your ass.
You're getting an early retirement now.
And you might wind up with one of them head conferences. Oh, man. I'm sorry. Not trying to be disrespectful.
Order it from me.
That's right. We try to get a little black business going over here, folks. You know, it's all good. Hey, that's going to be all right now. No, I got to say this here. Big ups to Brother Sadir, who handed over the keys. You know, this rebel cleric officially handed over the control of Nafja's Amin Ali Shrine to Iraq's top Shiite religious authority, a representative of Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, they say. Now, you know what? He gave up the keys. It's all on Sistani now. And you know what? He gonna be discredited. If he start kissing that booty and doing the imperialist duty, he gonna be discredited. That young man's credit is gonna go up considerably.
He's already discredited. That dude's been over there tap dancing to whatever tune Sam has wanted from the get-go. He's up there talking about Sadar making negotiations, and he ain't trying to hold Sam accountable because he's a lackey about all the oil they're stealing, all the revenue stuff, the electricity that's not on in all of these different parts. He's wherever Sam's pointing his finger at, that's where he's going.
Is he in the government?
Yeah.
Ayatollah is in the government.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Okay. Thank you very much, man. That's going to be all right now for the Making a Plane News Service. Stay with us a minute.
That's just going to about wrap it up with Slave tonight. It's clear that with the madness that's going on from corporate outsourcing to the resourcing of the corporate capital market ideology and the wars that it produces, not only do we have to keep on shooting, but we got to keep on pushing. Until the next time, Slave Revolt. Out.
Keep on pushing.